From Nashville and Charlotte, this is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Each week, our panel of shrinks takes a look at pop culture through the fascinating lens of psychology. I'm Dave Verhagen here in Nashville. I'm a psychologist, author, Comic-Con panelist, and number three on the FBI's Most Wanted list. Our trending topic today will be the psychology of sequels. That's in our second segment, but first let's meet our panel, all in Charlotte. Our first guy is a psychologist, author, Aspicon founder, and Comic-Con panelist, Dr. Frank Gaskell. Hello, Frank.
Hi, David.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I got a little bit of senioritis, getting ready to go on my little break.
And where are you going on your break? You've got like a 6-week break, right?
Correct.
Where are you going?
Gonna go to Bald Head Island, probably twice. And then hopefully to see you guys in Nashville and maybe a couple other little trips.
Excellent. Frank is a creature of habit, so when I asked him where is he going on his vacation, I knew the answer would be Bald Head Island.
That's right. It's the only place I go.
That's it. And also on the panel is, we used to say, not quite Dr. Wright, Emma Kate Wright, but now she is Dr. Wright. Really,
woo-hoo!
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So you are not officially degree conferred, but you have completed all degree requirements, and you are Emma Kate Wright, PhD. Is that correct?
That is correct. So I just recently defended my dissertation, and that's it.
That is awesome. All right. So I've lost my little catchy intro, but you've gained about 6 years of education. So
yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. It's a fair trade.
Yes.
Also, we have a guy who's been a contributor to ShrinkTank.com, a panelist for HeroesCon, and a licensed professional counselor, an expert on substance abuse treatment, and our own, very own certified Asian. He's written published book chapters on Game of Thrones, Star Wars, Walking Dead, and so on. And he served as all kinds of panelists in all kinds of conventions. Each week, he rounds up two great stories of psychology in the news that we call Being Human. Here's the one and only Jonathan Hederle.
All right, so this first research looks at how making people feel bad can be a strategy for helping them. So according to new research published in Psychological Science, people may try to make someone else feel negative emotions if they think experiencing those emotions will be beneficial in the long run. So one example that was cited in this study is inducing a fear of failure in a loved one who maybe is procrastinating instead of studying for an exam. So Frank, as our resident negative emotions expert, do you believe this? And do you do this in your own life?
Well, I had a really hard time with this study. It was hard to understand, and I don't see how they can translate their findings into the real world, because they basically divided people up into people who should feel empathy for another person's story or people who are supposed to just not show any emotion. And their way of measuring empathy was if the people were given a video game to shoot people and listen to intense music, or a video game to run away from zombies and give them a different kind of music. And I can't make a whole lot of sense of it. It's like you're saying, I think what they're trying to say is, if you're working out and you need to do better, then that's where these coaches will scream at you and get you mad so you can use that negative energy to do something. But this is like one of the worst ways to measure it, I think.
Yeah, I thought the study was fairly confusing as well. And I mean, yeah, we do need to try to motivate people to change. But I feel like Dave and Jonathan, you could probably speak to this with your work with motivational interviewing, where in order for somebody to change, they got to want to change. So that they're kind of negating that whole factor.
Can we insert crickets right there?
Okay.
I honestly, it felt like you were about to say something, Dave.
I know.
I'm sorry.
Really, Dave's stroking out.
Well, I thought the same thing. I can't see Jonathan, so it's hard for me to get the cue. Hold for editing.
Okay, editing.
Well, Frank, I'm wondering for you, like, isn't this your whole life of, like, trying to feel bad in order to do things?
Well, yes, but I'm not trying to feel bad. And if somebody made me feel worse, I'm not going to be doing any better. I'm just going to crawl into a little box. I mean, I don't know. I think that the title is a little bit confusing because it says making people feel bad can be a strategy for helping them. It's not that if somebody's yelling at me and trying to get me mad to work out, I don't call that feeling bad. It's just an emotion that I need to complete that task. So I don't know. It was a little hard for me to process.
Apart from the study being kind of not so great, do you think there's any truth to the main point of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's truth, just like the example of you've got somebody's procrastinating and you say to them, hey, you know, if you keep procrastinating, you're going to fail and not get that job. But also, am I trying to make the person feel bad or am I just pointing out natural real life consequences?
Right. But it's also if you're putting your opinion of what they should be doing on to them, mm-hmm. then they still may not do it. And so even if you're trying to help them, if again, back to that motivation piece, if it's not there, it won't happen.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's probably some difference between a loved one versus, like you said, a coach or a teacher, that negative emotion coming from somebody that you know actually really does care and is invested in you probably has a significant difference.
Right.
So, but moving on. So this next research comes out of the British Journal of Clinical Psychology, and they surveyed people's opinions of therapy and their strategies for coping with psychological problems. And what they found was that men and women want different things from therapy. They found significant differences. Women liked psychotherapy more than men did, and they speculate perhaps it's because of its emphasis on the sharing of emotion. Whereas men like support groups significantly more than women did, and they speculated that's perhaps due to the emphasis on the sharing of information. Men also use sex or pornography more than women to cope with stress. So, Emma-Kate, what do you make of these findings?
Honestly, this feels like it came from Dr. Obvious. This really just is like, well, yeah, women prefer to talk through things, at least if we're making generalizations about females. It's easier for us to be more process-oriented. We're kind of socialized that way. And then for men, it's more or less a lot of times guys like to be solution-oriented. How do we fix this? And so if you're going to get more information from a support group or some sort of group therapy, that sort of fits kind of the stereotypes.
I was listening to a story on NPR, I think it was, where they were talking to people who conduct research and they wanted to have them judge whether their studies or other studies were replicable. And researchers on the whole way overestimate the ability to replicate a study and also way overestimate the fact that it will be confirming the study's results. And I feel like that's some of the stuff that's going into this research is how much of this stuff is really legitimately being replicated and how much of it is real of what we're reading. I mean, I struggle with that.
Well, Frank, you mostly see guys in therapy. Jonathan does too. I do too. And do you think there's any truth to this idea that guys don't tend to like therapy as much as women? Is that your sense of it professionally?
I think when I look at parents, the majority of the parents of intact families that come into my office are women. The dads are often either not there because of work or really just don't seem to be invested in the therapy process. And the most common thing that I hear from the moms are, well, my husband thinks therapy is a waste of time.
Jonathan, how about you?
Well, it's interesting. Whenever I have to interact with parents, a lot of the parents want them to be able to, and it's mostly moms like Frank, they want their son to be able to open up and have somebody to talk to about life and the struggles. And a lot of the guys that's just doesn't register as an automatic way of helping deal with life stressors, the idea of talking to a complete stranger. The one piece that did surprise me a little bit because anecdotally, it hasn't always been the case with my work, is I actually have a lot of trouble getting guys to agree to do group stuff. And those that end up doing so, they find it really valuable because it helps normalize and it helps take the spotlight off of them. But the idea of more people knowing or hearing about their struggles, it can really be a huge hurdle for their pride and ego. So the idea of just one-on-one and somebody you pay that there's a strong confidentiality, you know, involved in, they tend to be more agreeable to that than a support group.
I do think it's changing a little bit, though. You know, I think there was a lot more reluctance for guys to participate in therapy when I first started, and we're talking about over a span of 20, 25 years. And now I don't sense that guys are as reluctant, especially young adult age guys, to come in. I'm just not seeing that much. I know that most of the time when a young guy comes into therapy, it's because someone else wanted them to come in. But once they get in, they're usually not that reluctant to do it. So it feels like it's something that, it feels like it's changing in some respects.
Yeah, I would agree with that too.
Alrighty. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, it's going to be our trending topic, which is the psychology of sequels. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Good psychology can change your life. At PsychBytes, we feature articles and videos with practical psychology that you can use every day. PsychBytes is a new psychology website with free articles and videos from dozens of the best psychology experts. Check it out on psychbytes.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen in Nashville, along with Frank Gaskell, Jonathan Hederle, and Emma Kate Wright in Charlotte. And our trending topic today is the psychology of sequels. And boy, oh boy, is this summer packed with sequels. We've got Cars 3, War for Planet of the Apes, Transformers, Despicable Me 3, Pirates of the Caribbean movie, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, John Wick 2, another Fast and the Furious movie, Fate of the Furious, an Alien movie, a Lego movie, an X-Men movie, a remake of Beauty and the Beast, a remake of or a new King Kong movie. I could keep going, but that's just a sample of it. It's just every week there is a couple sequels loaded up. Before we get into the psychology of it, have any of you seen any of these that you actually liked? Have there been any sequels this year so far that you really enjoyed?
I am going to go against the grain. I enjoyed the Alien movie. But I really haven't enjoyed anything else. I think I'm going to see Spider-Man very soon, and I think that will be the best sequel of the year.
I really liked Guardians of the Galaxy, too. It
wasn't, oh, yeah. I like that, too.
Yeah,
I
mean, it wasn't quite as great as the first one, but I still found it very enjoyable.
Yeah.
I saw, this was what, early spring John Wick 2, which is, I mean, I can't defend it as a good movie, but it's very enjoyable, and if you're going to go bigger and badder, which is sort of one of the themes of sequels, I think they did it pretty well.
Yeah, I like that movie, too. I'd put John Wick on the plus column. I'd also put Guardians of the Galaxy up there, too. I don't know if we can count Logan as a sequel, but if we can, so far that's probably in my top two or three movies I've seen this year, so not a bad movie. I also think that, did any of you see the King Kong movie?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was fun.
Well, yeah, that was fun, too.
That was a fun movie.
I think I'm just down on movies right now. Now that you're naming the ones that I've seen, you know, it was fun. It was good. But I think I'm just very gun-shy on movies at the moment.
Well, and I think we're in the middle of summer, and I think June was a particularly bad month of summer movies where we're thinking about King Kong or we're thinking about John Wick. Those were in February or late March. So it's been a while since, at least in terms of a sequel, that there's been a breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't see Guardians of the Galaxy, and I've heard fine things about it, but, I mean, I've heard it's also basically just the same thing that Guardians of the Galaxy 1 was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not dramatically better or worse. It's pretty much the same thing. If you like the first one, you probably like this one, I would guess. So let's get into the psychology of it. What we know is that sequels are big. If you look at the movies in any given year that are biggest at the box office, most of them are going to be sequels. If I look right now at the movies that have been released in 2017. The majority of them in the top 10 are known properties, either sequels or within a kind of a, you know, a family of movies. So I'll give you some examples of that. In the top 10 would be Guardians of the Galaxy, Logan, Wonder Woman, The Fate of the Furious, the Lego movie or the Lego Batman movie, Pirates of the Caribbean, Kong Skull Island. Then just below that's Despicable Me 3. Shortly after that's Cars 3. So the majority of them are known or sequels. So we've talked about this on the podcast before. What is your take on why we continue to go to see sequels and why there's such big money at the box office, even though we'd probably say over half of them are B-minus, C-plus movies at best?
For me, when I want to see a sequel, it's because I've become invested in the characters and the storyline. So a really good, you know, initial plot gets me wanting more. And there's also something about the creation of that world for the story. So whether it's the Marvel series, Harry Potter, you know, it's kind of just one of those things where I like seeing kind of the ebb and flow of the story, and I almost hope the sequel is a little bit darker so that then there could be another one. And so it just, as long as I keep wanting more, then I'm invested, and I like that.
Yeah, I think sequels by nature oftentimes have unresolved tension. So you want to see a completion or a complete arc, whether it be a character or a storyline. And most, I will not argue all, but most sequels only get greenlit because they're either a known commodity. So like Marvel, you think there's just this richness of storylines and ways they can go. Or it was a successful film to begin with, either commercially or critically or both. And so sequels oftentimes are born out of higher quality movies versus ones that underwhelm and they die as a singular, you know, film franchise.
Yeah, and I agree with him, Kate, in terms of being invested in the world, because if an Alien movie were to come out in the fall, I would go see it. I would see it opening night because it's nostalgia, but it's also I want to go back to that world, even if it's not the best story. I want to go back there.
Here's a premise I'm going to throw out there. In addition to what you're saying about being invested in the world and wanting to see where the characters are going and all that kind of stuff. But my premise is, and I'm not saying this about other people, not myself, but basically people are stupid, right? And that everybody wants something new, novel, but we all gravitate to familiar and comfortable, right?
Right.
And so that would be, for me, if I had to give one organizing idea, it would be our brains crave familiarity. They crave sameness. That's why, you know, if you look at what songs are the big hits in any given year, the song of the summer, there are certain things that are very predictable about it, about how it sounds, the kind of beat that it has, the way that the hook is constructed, all that kind of stuff. It's very rare to have a breakout song that's completely a new thing. Same thing with a movie. There are very few, like in the top 10 of movies this year, there's really only one original movie, and that's Get Out, right? That's if you think about it, everything else is some kind of known property for the most part. Would you agree with this as far as like that part of the reason why sequels are so big is because we basically are, as much as we don't like it, we're kind of simple-minded folk who like familiarity and sameness.
Well, I do agree with you, but I wouldn't say it's because we're stupid. It's more or less like...
No, wait. I'm saying you're stupid.
Yes, I am dumb. No, let's clarify. Yeah. Okay.
But she's not smart.
Glad we got that covered.
Not smart, Dr. Wright. There's your new call.
Not smart. I'm always Dr. Wrong. But anyway, so, no, I do agree with you, and part of my rationale behind that is because it's so stinking expensive to go to the movies now. And so if I'm going to shell out a huge chunk of cash, like I want to know it's at least going to be something I'll moderately enjoy.
Yeah, and that I more along the lines that these movies, and I've said this in the past, are most all of them are geared toward an average IQ. And I mean, spoiler alert, in the Transformers movie, Merlin, they go back to Merlin, and it turns out that Transformers were back then. I mean,
did you see the Transformers?
No, I'm refusing to see it. But I've heard some people I know tell me about the story, and they're so into it, but it's more of that average IQ. And I think that's what Hollywood plays to. And Hollywood has to in order to break even, because they cannot compete with Netflix. They just can't. You can't do something unique in film anymore, even if that's my point.
Well, it's a weird – I mean, I think there's something – I think you're onto something, Dave, but it's got to be more, because we're basically saying the familiarity breeds laziness, or that just the known commodity – and yet you look at television, and that's the whole premise of great shows, is that they build off of seasons and storylines in the same way that film does. But I wouldn't argue that television suffers that same stupid syndrome. You look at some of the greatest television series, and they're able to build and expand the universe and the characters that they do. So there's a part of me that also thinks with blockbusters especially, which are going to be highly susceptible to sequels and franchises, is the marketing. The onslaught of marketing, and they are so sophisticated, and you have to think there's just as much psychologists involved in marketing as there are marketers, of how to get people to believe, I need to see this. My life will not be complete if I don't go shell out $15 to see this movie on opening weekend.
And I'm praying for the intelligence of the American people, and I think Transformers.
Good luck.
Well, I think hopefully Transformers gave me some data to that, because it only made $68 million over 4 or 5 days.
Oh, wait a minute! Wasn't that your pick for the number one movie of the summer?
Shut up, Heatherly.
If we're talking about the intelligence of an American.
Well, I was betting on the intelligence of Americans, and I might be betting wrong.
Well, let me just throw this out there. It's the 15th highest grossing film of the year. It's made $120 million.
Okay, well then, scratch everything I just said.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I definitely understand what you guys are saying, and certainly what's built into television is that you watch things episode after episode, season after season. And with movies, I think part of what I'm saying is that a movie has historically been kind of a self-contained thing. And the reason now that sequels are not just hits, but really Hollywood is built on sequels, right? If it weren't for the sequels, the industry would be in hurt and shape, is because people are more likely to go to see a Pirates of the Caribbean movie that is a B-, then take a chance on, let's say, a Baby Driver or something like that, that might be a better movie, but is a stretch for them. Like, it's not familiar. They don't know how to get into it.
Sure. I was actually listening to a podcast recently, and they made the hypothesis that we're in the era where there's been role reversal between movies and television. So you have like Marvel, you have the DC, you even have the Star Wars, and now they're being created almost like old television series where they're just adding to the universe at different angles. And television now more and more has singular storylines. They pointed to like True Detective or Fargo or some of these, or even The Leftovers that was originally going to be only 3 seasons, where they've constructed it to where there's an arc that's complete, and then they walk away from it. So I thought that was a real fascinating observation. I don't know if it holds true, you know, under scrutiny, but I could see why they pointed to those commodities as evidence of that.
Well, and I'll tell you, I agree with that, and I'll tell you part of why that's happened too is because the best writers have migrated to
Absolutely.
Television.
Absolutely. Right? You look at sequels, and they'll have 5 or 6 different writers.
Right. Yeah, it's just, it's a script by committee. You have two guys that'll write it, and then they'll have a script doctor come in, and then he'll get a credit for it, and then they'll overhaul it, and somebody else will get a script. I mean, they'll have multiple writers, and it's all done to kind of hit certain beats and certain script patterns
yep.
that feel, even if an audience doesn't know it, it feels familiar. A lot of the screenwriting industry right now, in terms of instruction on screenwriting, is really how to hit certain beats in a screenplay. Like at page 5, you need to be at this beat. At page 11, you need to be at this beat. You know, it really is very mechanical in terms of how to do that. And that's what we're seeing, because those are the things that sell, because people know, subconsciously or not, they know what they're getting.
Well, and now not only do we have multiple screenwriters, we're moving into the era of multiple directors for a movie too.
Yeah,
yeah, right. Your Star Wars movie, your Han Solo movie, case in point for that. All right, we're going to take one less break, and when we come back, it will be our doctor's orders. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Hero House Publishing is pleased to announce Heroic Inspirations by Michael Kreitzer. Over the ages, superheroes in various forms have been speaking to humanity in togas, robes, and now tights and capes. They speak to us about the human condition. They help us work through our fears and failures. Heroic Inspirations draws out rich lessons superheroes provide for our daily lives. How does Superman teach us to deal with difficult people? What do the X-Men tell us about balancing individual and communal identities? Superheroes speak to these and many other life questions. Michael Kreitzer has been researching and teaching on superheroes for over 10 years, and now his book, Heroic Inspirations, is available to you at herohousepublishing.com or amazon.com. Order your copy today.
Back again with Dave Verhaeghe, Frank Gaskell, Jonathan Hederle, and Emma Kate Wright for the Shrink Tank Podcast. And we wrap this all up with our doctor's orders. These are things that we're personally enjoying in pop culture. Emma Kate, what do you have?
So I have recently gotten into Planet Earth 2. I know this came out a while ago, but it's on Amazon Video now. And I'm just like blown away by some of the shots that they get with all the drone technology we have now. So I highly recommend people checking that out.
All right. And Frank?
I want to recommend a documentary that I found that many of you may know about, but it's the true side, the inside story of The Silence of the Lambs. And it tells the story of how the movie was created, how was Thomas Harris, I guess was his name, did his research in creating the book based on true stories. And it's pretty fascinating.
Where'd you watch it?
I found it on YouTube.
Oh, it's like a free YouTube video.
Yeah, it's pretty old.
All right. Very cool. Jonathan?
Well, I mentioned how June, I think, has been a horrible month for movies, but I'm excited about July. And partly with what we've talked about here today, there's actually a lot more original content coming out that I'm excited to see. At the end of the month, you have Atomic Blonde. In a couple weeks, you have Dunkirk. And my recommendation is another original property called Baby Driver, Edgar Wright's new action comedy film. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I do think it's a movie that by seeing it on the big screen, it captures something that you might lose a little bit on the smaller screen. Baby Driver.
So let me ask you about Baby Driver. What would you give it as a grade?
It rests right around the B+, A-. It really gets an A- for just energy and experience, but like it's a genre pick, so the story itself is pretty pedestrian or familiar.
So we saw it with a group of 6 guys here in Nashville, and 3 of the guys gave it a solid A, and 3 of them gave it a B. And all 3 of the guys who gave it a B are in the room right now. So Austin, Hunter, and myself, we were in the kind of like good but not great range. So I want to ask you, I'm serious about this. I kind of feel like I may have missed this movie a little bit. Like I liked it. I thought it was good. But I'm a little bit baffled about why people think it's an A. Do you have a thought about that?
Well, I don't think it's an A, but I think one of the things that requires like sustained scrutiny and observation to really appreciate the film is that the editing of most of the movie is synced with the music. And it's something that you can, if you focus on just one or the other, you miss how doors slamming, gunfire, entire skidding is in the exact synchronization of the soundtrack. And to be able to pull that off with long camera shots, so we're talking 5, 10, 15-second camera shots, that is a level of talent to be able to pull that off. Because Michael Bay does that, but his shots are like 0.3 seconds per cut. Whereas Edgar Wright, you may have a scene, he has one tracking shot scene that's a minute, minute and a half, and it's completely synchronized to music, the door slamming, people walking by, somebody tripping. I think it's amazing. And that's one of the things I picked up early on that elevated the experience for me.
Well, I think I get that part of it. And I think the three of us would say the technical part of it was great, outstanding, an A. But really, the story was kind of meh, so-so. Like, I don't think we loved the story, but we loved the technical piece of it.
So yeah. I think that probably just carried me to enjoying the movie and probably forgiving some of the kind of the pedestrian story outline.
Right. I got it. Well, the recommendation that I'm going to give, my doctor's order, is a Netflix series that I didn't think I was going to love, but I absolutely loved it. It's called The Crown. It is the story of Queen Elizabeth from the time she's a kid up through her young adulthood when she has taken over the throne. I really was going to watch it because Ellen and I, my wife and I, were looking for something to watch together, and it was something that she was up for. And it's just outstanding. The production values are great. The themes are great. There is a scene in the second to last episode with Winston Churchill, who's played by John Lithgow, where he's talking to the guy who's been commissioned to paint his portrait. That is one of my favorite scenes in a television series in the last several years. It is remarkable. So I'd highly recommend it. It's a 10-episode series on Netflix called The Crown. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. We hope you'll check out shrinktank.com for articles, videos, and polls about movies and TV and music and all kinds of things in pop culture. Be sure to check out shrinktank.com. And also make sure you follow us on Twitter @shrink_tank and like us on Facebook by searching for the Shrink Tank Podcast. Our producer and theme music composer is Sean Beck. In the Queen City, it's Emma Kate Wright, Jonathan Hederle, and Frank Gaskell. And from Music City, I'm Dave Verhagen. Thanks for listening. Please tell all your friends about us and make it a good week. Shrink Tank.